Good afternoon. Welcome to the final high notes of our 2023 season. I see many familiar and friendly faces. Thank you for being with us all season. As you know, these talks are not only live here at Bad Harriet's, the speakeasy of the Hotel Jerome, but we are broadcasting them on Aspen Public Radio. And I'd like to say thank you to Aspen Public Radio for their support of our work all summer as well. Before I introduce our extraordinary guest, I have one very unusual commercial to give, because people often say to me, what's your favorite concert? And of course, with more than 300, I usually feel it's not smart.
Ito Ineo, that's his favorite.
Yeah. Well, it's definitely going to be my favorite. But I wanted to just let you know about something unusual happening at the Chamber Symphony on Friday at 5:30. We had planned well over a year ago a really wonderful program. It has Fima Bronfman playing the Schumann Concerto. That by itself would make it a fabulous concert. Two really wonderful new works by Gabriella Smith and Gabriella Lena Frank, the two Gabriellas. And that was going to be a great program. But then my very dear friend Mark Menon called me. Mark is the son of Peter Menon. Peter was one of the great American 20th century composers. He was the president of the Juilliard School at the time that I attended it. He handed me my master's degree and my doctoral degree. And so it turned out that it had been known that Peter had started writing a violin concerto for Roman Totenberg in the 50s. Now, many of you will remember or know that Roman was on the faculty of the Aspen Music Festival in the 50s. Really, really brilliant American violinist, the father of Nina Totenberg, which is just a little factoid to have. But Peter Menon had begun writing a violin concerto for Roman. Other things happened. He became director of the Peabody Institute and then president of the Juilliard School, and he never finished it. So, Georgianne Menon, his widow, who's also a very dear friend of mine, going through the papers, found that he had completed the slow movement of this violin concerto, and in fact, it was fully orchestrated in his own beautiful hand. In those days, composers wrote music with pencil on paper. And so, at length, their son, Mark Menon, called me and said, we now have this piece. What do you think we should do? And I said, well, what you should do is let Aspen give the world premiere of it. And I said, and furthermore, Bobby McDuffie, who was my fellow student at Juilliard and also very close with both Bill Schumann and Peter Menon, I said, obviously, Bobby has to be the one to play it. And he is already coming at the end of August, so let's put it there. So we dropped this onto this Friday's program. It's a long way to say, please come on Friday. Peter's son Mark will be with us, and Bobby McDuffie playing the world premiere of a piece written 70 years ago by one of the great American composers. So that, yes.
Thanks.
So, oh, and in fact, Bobby gives a full recital tonight, and he then changed his program to put a piece he often plays of Peter Menon's on tonight's program. Indeed. That's at 7:30 in Harris Hall tonight. So I'm delighted that we're joined by Matthew Polanzani. We will also be joined in 25 minutes by Robert Spano. Matthew Polanzani, one of the great, great lyric tenors of our time. I just wrote a few notes. More than 300 performances at the Metropolitan Opera in more than 20 roles. Matthew has appeared literally with every major orchestra in the world. He does a lot of oratorio work as well as opera, but he has been on the stages of every great opera house, in the world, and most of them like in the past 2 years. I don't know how your travel agent...
My wife gets mad at me, actually, because of the travel, but I don't know. Anyway, there's nothing we can do about
that. Yeah, but your travel agent must have a house with tennis courts.
No, I live outside of New York City. I can't afford tennis courts where I live.
So Matthew won the Richard Tucker Award and then the Beverly Sills Award. Let's just start talking, because one thing that strikes me is the range of what you sing. And so, as I said, oratorio, and you do messiahs, you do Elijahs, you do all kinds of stuff. But in terms of opera, you sing a lot of Mozart, but you sing all the way up through great Puccini heroes. And you also sing the French repertoire and repertoire in French, like Don Carlos in French. And so is that difficult vocally to be doing such different kinds of projects?
Well, I would say no, as a generality, because, you know, even in the very beginning of my career, I was always aware that Rossini, for example, which is definitely more a lighter orchestration, etc., except for like in the case of like William Tell maybe or whatever, but as a generality, I knew that that stuff would be short-lived for me, and I knew that my voice was going in a bigger repertory sort of direction. So the way I sort of ran my career, and I was very lucky to have a manager who saw my career path the way I saw it, which it doesn't often work like that. And you know, and so he was on board with the idea of me singing a lot of Mozart, and here I am at 54 and still, like, this is a huge Mozart summer for me. I just had Magic Flute in Ravinia with the CSO, and now I'm here with you guys, and I'm going directly after this for Clemenza di Tito in Vienna. I mean, like, it's a great summer for me. I'm so happy about it. But of course, at my age, I mean, it's getting harder to get these Mozart parts, and with good reason, frankly. I mean, my voice is capable of a lot more than is necessary sound-wise for this part. Like, when my voice is big enough to sing Don Carlo or Tosca or Hoffmann or Werther or whatever, those pieces that require more metal and more power, you know, like, I definitely benefited as a 30-year-old, a 35-year-old, a 40-year-old tenor, singing these parts, these Mozart parts, in all these big theaters. And so I'm aware, even as I'm being selfish and I'm thinking to myself, boy, you know, like, I tell my agent all the time, please, any Mozart you can find for me, I'm always glad for it. I love going back to it. And so I'm aware that I'm taking parts away from younger tenors, perhaps. But I mean, you know, I mean, I'm still selfish about it, because I think Mozart's especially good for me. It was always my home. As I took a step outside of my regular repertory, I would always come back to Mozart. And if I sang a Verdi Requiem or Don Carlo or whatever, Bohème, I would always want to have some Mozart somewhere in the neighborhood, you know. And in fact, even now, like, if I'm working on some section of an aria by Verdi or whoever that I don't like how I'm doing it or whatever, I'll often sing through something similar in Mozart to get that home base feeling that I have when I'm singing this music. So that'll help me find my way through bigger repertory. You know, and the other thing is that like, I remember the first time I sang Tales of Hoffmann. I think it was around 2011, maybe, or 2012. And I just remember having a conversation with the conductor at the time saying, listen, if you're looking for Domingo's Hoffmann or Neil Schickoff's crazy Hoffmann, then we're not in the right... We need to get on a different page, because I'm going to try my hardest to sing every piano and pianissimo that Offenbach wrote. You know, I'm not gonna sing loud all night long. I'm not gonna yell. I'm gonna sing it like it was written. And I'm not denigrating, by the way, Domingo or Shikoff at all. I adore both of their Hoffmanns and studied them absolutely to see what the, how they treated the language and how they treated the characters. I'm just saying that I'm a different singer from them. And so, you know, like, I said, we need to get on, and he was completely down with it. So, like, I never tried to sing any of the bigger repertory pieces. Like, I don't try to sing Tosca like Corelli sings it or sang it or Pavarotti sang it or even anybody from today sings it. I sing it like I sing it. I'm aware that my voice is big enough. I cover the orchestra without any trouble. And I just try to be as real as a character with my voice and with my body as I can so that the audience is completely in it with me.
Well, that is indeed a hallmark of what you do, is that you do have the power, the, you know, if you will, spinto, that you can go big, but that you bring a lot of subtlety and also great acting.
Yeah, I mean, but of course, and I even say it to the kids, to the artists who I'm singing with, I'm like, listen, you guys, make an effort to be quiet. Make an effort to understand why that makes sense for you as an artist, not just because Mozart wrote it. You know, make an effort to understand why these things are, why the composer wrote it that way. And then from there, make an effort to maximize the impact of piano or pianissimo. And it's funny, I don't really understand how well it works in our hall here with the microphones, because it's very tough to get a sense. But I mean, like, you'll hear me, yeah, I sing loud plenty of times, but I also try to maximize every possibility to be as quiet as I can, and hopefully those colors will come through in the performance over the speaker system.
Well, you mentioned your early manager, and since at our heart we're a school, and you're working with our young artists in this production, Renee Fleming often says that she was fortunate to have people when she started out who really understood, should she go to Europe, should she not, should she stick with Handel for a while, should she not, and that it's much harder for young people today.
Oh, yeah. Well, here's the thing. Well, there's a few different things, I guess, that, and Renee is right. I mean, and I also count myself equally lucky. I mean, like, the number of people who I trusted with vocal advice has been two, really, my whole life, and maybe a third. And like my teacher and my wife is a singer too. She gave up her career when we started with the children, but I trust her ear. Her ear was trained the way my ear was trained. And my teacher, who's been my teacher since 1998, and she studied with the woman who taught me. So, like, she teaches completely differently, but her ear was trained by Margaret Harshaw. That was a woman who taught me how to sing. So, my circle has been small for my whole life. And then there's some coaches who I trust, but as a generality, the coaches who I work with who are just helping me figure out how to interpret rarely talk to me about vocal things. You know, and I don't want them to talk to me about vocal things because they're pianists and they're musicians, but they're not singers, and that makes a big difference. So younger singers today have a more uphill battle, and we all have uphill battles. I mean, like, in the days when I was coming up, Germany was closed to young American singers. You know, like, and now they're all over the whole fest system in Germany. And every time I'm in a house in Germany, I meet tons of young American singers. But that, in my day coming up, that didn't exist. However, New York City Opera was a very important part of why I became a bigger star at the Met. And it was because they saw me working there, and they saw what I was doing. They understood that I was capable of, I mean, like, I'm virtually certain that James Levine came to hear me at City Opera because he wanted to hear what I sounded like and looked like in a bigger part. You know, and like that kind of thing, that loss, it's a huge loss for young singers. City Opera was an important theater, and the fact that New York City can only support one opera house, and even that barely, is a little troubling. And if I'm a younger singer, I'd be worried about it, you know? And the other thing I wanted to say was, what directors often ask, and we are lucky in this production, we have Francesca Zambello, who's our director, and definitely more of the old school, which isn't to say her vision is old school, it's not, but what she understands what vocalists have to do, that's what I mean. She's a singer's director, but we don't have so many of these today, and oftentimes, especially in Europe, but even here in America, we might be asked to sing high C like this. You know, and I'm sorry, like that doesn't translate. And, you know, and that's, but, and of course, but we as artists, we want to oblige, we want to help bring a vision to life. And so, yeah, of course. And when you're young, you might be able to get away with it. But the trouble is that it costs in a way you don't understand it costs because you're young. And so I had time as a 30-year-old and a 35-year-old and a 40-year-old to solidify my technique largely with directors who understood what singing was. And this is a big problem for young singers today, I think, you know. And conductors who always play too loud. Oh, hi Bob. Hi. Hi. sorry. he knows I love him.
You too.
Good. Come on and have a seat. That was perfectly timed. Anyway, it's a real question mark, because when you have to behave like that on the stage, it's hard to solidify a technique that is built on structural and muscular integrity. And so, I don't know, it's a difficult road, but hopefully every young singer who we have here with us now and all over the world, hopefully these guys have people like a small group around them who they can trust and who they can work with to help them grow.
Well, thank you. And please welcome Robert Spano, our music director. Rather than take time to introduce him, I'll just say he is the most wonderful person on earth, and we're thrilled that he's here. Although, Matthew was just saying, you're playing way too loud.
I said it in his earshot, though, so yes, that means it wasn't so bad.
Okay, so we're talking first. Actually, there are several things I'd like to talk about with the two of you, but about Mozart's opera Idomeneo, which goes up tomorrow night at 7 p.m. in the Benedict Music Tent. Robert conducting, Matthew as the title role, Idomeneo. It's a quite extraordinary work, and I thought we would start in it on the fact that Matthew has sung this role at the Met, and indeed it houses all over the world. The Met production takes 3 hours and 20 minutes, and we were thinking about that for Aspen. I thought we might interpolate some additional arias in order
to... Yeah, because 3 hours and 20 minutes isn't long enough. Let's go for the whole thing.
Bring it all the way up to 4 hours. But instead, we decided to make some modifications, which indeed most places do some modification. But do you want to talk about the artistic process you and Francesca Zambello, the director, went through?
Well, I think that was one of our first thoughts, was how do we approach this work in a way that's appropriate for the way we are presenting it and where we are. In the tent, our production capacity is limited. I love the creativity that comes out of dealing with those limitations, costumes that impede performing and all of that. In a way, it's a hybrid of an operatic production and a concert presentation. You could say it's a pared-down operatic production, or you could say it's a highly enhanced concert presentation, and somewhere in the middle is what we're doing. And Francesca Zambello was the perfect partner to approach this work with the attitude of how do we present it in such a way that is powerful, viable, and appropriate for the Aspen Music Festival. And she immediately saw the possibility of creating a version that many orchestras would like to use as a way of presenting this music, that many opera companies who don't want to engage in the four-hour version would like to use. And her ruse, or her key into the paring down of the length of the work, was to introduce a narrator who is a Trojan woman who's been a victim of this circumstance, who's telling us the story from her point of view, which eliminates, and at one rehearsal after we'd finished an act, I said, this is the first time people are going to leave a performance of Idomeneo saying, oh, I know what happened. Because so often, you know, we sit through the recitatives, which are compelling in their own way and intensely dramatic, but not always clear in terms of the plot and who's who and related how. And so there's something wonderful about the clarity of this production in terms of those aspects, who's who and what's happening. And the other thing is that it puts into relief the difficulty in cutting a work like Idomeneo is if you cut anything you love, you won't cut anything. You can't. You can't just say, well, I don't like that, because it's all lovable. But you start picking out the things that have to do with the flow of the show. How does the drama unfold in such a way that there's a real momentum to the performance? And at the same time, how do we preserve the greatest music that's in there? And I think Francesca's version is absolutely brilliant. I know I finish an act of our version of the show, and I feel like it went by in a blink of an eye.
I think that the idea of a narrator might seem very odd in the setting of an opera, but I believe that the core truth of the piece and the musicality of the piece and all that, it's totally intact. I mean, we took out recitative in order to shorten the piece, but the dramatic flow is clearer and more concise. I mean, like I'd freely admit that I had question marks when the score first came to me, you know. But having been a part of it, I think we're still being really true to Mozart, and I think an audience will totally appreciate the gravity and the weight of the story, despite not hearing us say, you know. I can't think of a recit right off the top of my head, but I mean, like, you know, I think we're being very truthful, you know. Sorry, just to.
No, yeah. That's great. I similarly was dubious, and in order to assuage one's own conscience, you know, fearing Wolfy lightning bolts, you remember that he was a man of the theater, and he wrote a new version for Vienna. And he was constantly tinkering and making things appropriate for the venue and for the people involved. He was an equally great theatrical mind as he was a musical mind.
Well, and so on the same lines, there's a very famous and quite lengthy ballet in Idomeneo, and it's just absolutely glorious music, and I urge you to go home and get a recording and listen to it.
You won't hear it tomorrow.
But we're not.
No, I thought we were doing it, but you were doing the ballet and I was conducting. No?
We're not doing the ballet. Idomeneo is also very famously what's called a chorus opera. It has an unusually large number of choruses, and they're especially important in the action. So we do have a chorus happening. Shall we tell that story or just run past it?
Well, I think the good news about that story is that Seraphic Fire is here. They are performing Haydn Creation on Sunday, and they're just a marvelous chorus, and they're combining with the members of the AOTVA program, and as a consequence, we have this terrific chorus. The Seraphic Fire chorus is up in the loft, sort of supplementing the opera theater singers who are in the scene.
Well, when I was an undergraduate, I participated in a concert performance of Idomeneo in the chorus, naturally. And so coming back to this, when someone proposed cutting one of the choruses. It's the one that begins "Placido e il mar, andiamo." I just said, no, that will not be cut. So
I mean, I have to say, this is a very major league. The chorus is a big part of the scene. You know, their commentary is really important, especially once it comes out. And if you don't know the story, I mean, like, you probably all know the story of Idomeneo. I mean, like, once it comes out that Idomeneo's son is the one to be sacrificed, O Voto Tremendo, it's one of the great choruses of all of opera, not just all of Mozart or whatever. It is unbelievably dramatic and heartfelt and emotional. And yeah, I mean, like, the chorus is a very important part of this opera.
Well, Francesca said a lovely thing in a different talk she was giving here, that first of all, the theatricality, and that if one approaches Idomeneo as a sort of antique opera seria, you know, item not really current or relevant, one misses what it meant to Mozart, because these are her words, but she said possibly no composer ever loved his characters the way Mozart did, and that comes through in every character, who are very complex in this opera.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny, I never really thought of it, actually. But yeah, you can see it. It's true, and it's interesting also, because each of these, one of the things that I love about this piece for myself is the weight of what Idomeneo is dealing with. And of course, we know historically about Mozart's troubles with his own father, which they didn't reach this level, obviously. But I mean, like that, well, you know, this dynamic was certainly a part of his writing of this piece. And this is very, I mean, it's funny just thinking, I'm ticking through my mind about Giovanni, who is ultimately not a lovable character in a way, you know, but a guy who we can't stop watching, you know, yeah, I completely agree with her. And it's funny, now I'm thinking to myself about the stock romantic characters that I might get in a Puccini or a Donizetti or whatever. And not to say that they didn't love those guys, but they could be any guy, you know. I don't know. I like what she said. That makes sense to me. Yeah.
Well, and I just feel like saying this. One of the great things in opera, which cannot happen in other forms of theatrical presentation, is that 2, 3, 4, 5, even 6 characters can be singing simultaneously and yet conveying completely different dramatic messages or emotional messages. And for me, one of the greatest of all ensembles of this kind is the third act quartet in Idomeneo, where 4 people are singing, they have completely different things happening to them, and they're thinking and feeling different things, and you get every single one of them. I just felt like talking about that. It's my favorite.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's incredible, actually, because everybody has their own subtext, and every subtext has virtually nothing to do with the other one's subtext, which is, you know, and when I say subtext, I'm just talking about what we have words in a libretto, but it's the things that the what these words mean to me. Idamante has no idea why I'm so mad at Neptune. He doesn't understand what just happened between Neptune and I on the sea, you know? And Ilya doesn't get why Idamante has to go, you know? And of course, nobody understands it. Idamante doesn't get it either. And Elektra is only interested in her own, you know, raising her own station. I mean, everybody has, everybody's got their own idea. Everybody's got their own, and we're all singing together. And oftentimes in unison, with the same words, but with completely different subtexts. And yeah, you know what? That's another one. I hadn't really thought of it. I mean, like, it doesn't happen very often in opera where everybody's saying the same words, but they mean completely different things to each character. And of course, that quartet starts and ends with the most sad, one of the saddest lines ever sung in opera. And weird, because it's in a major key somehow. But I mean, when Idamante says, I'm going, and I'm going alone. You know, I mean, like, and that's how he starts it, and that's how he ends it. And another sort of musical device that I don't know if I experience in other pieces. I mean, your brain is probably better than mine with that sort of thing. But anyway, yeah, very cool.
Well, since we're cataloging the various aspects of Mozart's genius, I would throw in, if there's any attention left for it in the experience of the work, but you don't really have to pay attention to it because it comes in subliminally anyway. And it's not an aspect of Mozart that's commonly discussed, but it's his orchestration. His use of the orchestra is extraordinary. My assistant, who is a graduate, an alum of the ACCA program here, and he's covering me for our production of Vito Manero, he asked me the other day, why are there clarinets here? And I said, well, I think you probably ought to go answer that for me. Because really, when you start looking, the orchestra is a different combination of instruments for different arias and choruses and aspects of the opera. It changes. It's not just everybody all the time. So sometimes you'll have a combination of clarinets and bassoons. Sometimes you'll only have the flutes and the oboes. The trumpets make rare appearances. And maybe one of the most powerful moments in the show, among the many powerful moments in the show, is when the voice of Neptune declaims with the accompaniment of three trombones. Now, already by the time of Mozart, trombones had been used enough so that they were associated in opera with the supernatural, with the underworld or with the paranormal. And it's the only place in the opera the trombones play is for the voice and the pronouncement. And it's terrifying. I find that moment absolutely terrifying.
Yeah, absolutely.
And they're good trombonists.
It's terrifying because of what Mozart wrote, not because the trombonists can't play. That's all I got you.
Well, no, I mean, because through the Baroque era, trombones were associated with the sacred also. And the piccolo only in the storm.
Oh, that's right. He uses a piccolo. He never used it again. It's amazing. And only for, what, 10 bars or something.
Yeah, also, I know I've noticed over all these years, because it's a long time for me with this part. I think the first time was in 2008 or 9 or something like that. I've noticed over the years that orchestration, particularly in Ilya's third act aria, feels a lot heavier, right? Is it? Yeah, I mean, that was just my... I mean, I never saw an orchestra score, but I mean, like, but for me, this is a Mozart way of saying that her weight is heavier and heavier. And yeah, she is, this is a, you know, I only caught it by over all these performances I've listened to, but I mean, like, yeah, this orchestration is, it's just a deeper, more full sound of orchestra than I might normally expect. Compared to the things she's saying in the first and second. Anyway, I mean, like, this is just dramatic device being offered by a composer, working at a really high level. And this is middle Mozart, too, right? I mean, like, and there's some things, I mean, I said it to you the very first day I saw you, the moment right in between, right after he reveals that it's Idamante, there's like a, what is that, a 4-bar passage or something where Mozart goes crazy. I mean, he goes crazy. He never leaves the tonality of where he is, but somehow he's nowhere near it. And there are like, and all you feel, all I ever feel in that moment is like my soul crumbling. I feel my heart absolutely just tearing open. And then, and it finishes when those 4 bars finish, I say, and now the parent has to kill his progeny, his son, you know? I mean, like, and the way he sets that up, I mean, so I said to Bob, I'm like, listen, maestro, if you don't mind, play these 4 bars, like, as slowly as you feel like you can and still being true to what's there in the score, because it's such a revelation. And he didn't play it. He didn't make a noise like that over all the rest of his, because I sang all the rest of his stuff. I mean, like, I never heard anything like those 4 bars, you know? I mean, it's really incredible. In the moment when we're in the opera and I'm talking and I finally have revealed that it's Idamante, you'll hear there's a, just very chromatic and not dissonant, because it's still Mozart. But I mean, for him, I feel like it's very forward-looking, these four bars. And I don't understand. Maybe he did it, and I didn't. I haven't caught it in all the other things I sang his. But very cool. Nothing to add?
Well, no, I'm with you. It always sounds to me like your heart is being torn wide open.
Well, one thing that Renee Fleming and Patrick Summers in creating the new version of our opera program thought is they observed that a hallmark of our training in Aspen for decades, many decades, has been what we call side by side. And so that the orchestra students have their lessons and they're practicing, and then they come up on stage and they're sitting next to the concertmaster of the Chicago Symphony, or the principal horn player of the Los Angeles Philharmonic, or the harpist of the Vienna Philharmonic. And, you know, that this brings them to a different kind of attention in their rehearsal, even than when they're playing in the Curtis or Juilliard or, you know, Colburn Orchestra. So Renee and Patrick said, what if we did that in the opera program? And so we chose each summer an opera where we could have a person of world stature on the stage rehearsing with the young people. And so last summer we started this off with Bryn Terfel singing Falstaff, you know, an opera that arguably we could never have done in the regular opera program, but we could do when we had a Falstaff. And then this summer with Matthew Polanzani singing the title role in Idomeneo. So you don't have to comment on how great it is that you're doing this for us, but maybe you could comment on how great it is that we have someone like Matthew.
Well, I just to say quickly, when my agent told me, I mean, I love the idea. I love this idea. And I think to myself of my time in young art programs, like at Lyric Opera of Chicago, singing some yip yap guy, fourth idiot from the left, like, but standing next to someone like, you know, Ben Heppner or Placido or Carol Van Ness or Kiri Takanawa or anyone. I mean, like, just being able to watch them work, watch them process, watch them take in information, digest it, and then use it. That was huge. I love the idea. I love this idea that to be able to be next to these guys so that they can see, you know, what they can see, what a person who's been doing it for a long time, how they do this, how they work, how they process, how they relate. You know, sorry, I didn't. I was only going to say one thing, and then I kept going, and I'm sorry about that. But and hopefully I haven't killed your entire answer, Bob. But I mean, no, I mean, like, I just wanted to say that I did. I love this idea, and would have, as a young artist, I would have begged for something like this, just to stand next to any of those artists, who are leading artists of the day, just to work next to them and say, oh man, I sang with Sam Raimi, oh my gosh, it was incredible, you know, or whoever you want to say. But anyway, so sorry.
No, that was it. Yeah. That was great. Well, we were rehearsing without you for a while. Yes. And then when you arrived, it's a shot in the arm to the room, to the process, to the kids. What the kids?
I know, we have to say kids. But yeah.
But they're young artists. Oh, yeah. We're not supposed to say young anymore either. Artists, the fellows of the opera program. Right. You can feel the electricity that happens when you enter the process, and you can also see their understanding of what they're doing being enhanced by witnessing what you're doing and by interacting with what you're doing. And I think it's just a testament to that fundamental philosophy of the Aspen, the school aspect of the Aspen Festival is that opportunity. And it works everywhere we do it in a most remarkable and beautiful way. I'm reminded when I think about that when I was a kid, my father was a flute maker, and so when I was 8, I was handed a flute. And my teacher would always play with me at my lessons. And there was a very powerful instruction going on that was wordless, of learning by being supported, but also by imitating, and just by hearing and learning by example. And it's interesting, one might fear that such a thing would, just do what I'm doing, is not the message. It's not that at all. There's actually a kind of support for finding something that's your version of what your teacher is demonstrating and exemplifying. It's a beautiful process.
Well, I've heard that form of teaching called move over, dearie. That, the student is playing and finally the teacher says, move over, dearie. And also, this is an extremely random remark, but a friend of mine went to Calcutta to study sitar, and my friend was, very American, Anglo, and encountered the extreme of this, because the form of pedagogy is a reverse of move over, dearie, because one comes into the lesson, the teacher plays a passage, and then you play the passage, and then most times the teacher says no, and that's the end. There endeth the lesson. So no explanation, and a very American thing which my friend did is like, okay, can you tell me like what I did wrong? And the teacher says no. Listen better next time. So anyway,
I mean, I have to say, because I've gotten older in the business, I'm more often giving master classes, and like when I work with the young artists in New York, I work with the young artists in Chicago when I'm there, when I go to San Francisco. I mean, like when I go to these places, I often work with them. And I hate to say it because I'm a tenor, but I mean, tenors are notoriously bad at listening. And there have been a few over the years who I've just said, man, because I prefer not to demonstrate if I can help it, I don't mind to demonstrate, or if I'm looking for a sound that they haven't given me. I mean, the problem with teaching is you got to be able to say the very same thing 60, 70, 100 different ways before somehow it clicks and they get it, But I mean, the number of times when, it's so funny, like I think to myself, well, I could never do what that sitar teacher did. But the number of times I thought to myself, this guy just doesn't listen. He can't hear what I'm doing and he doesn't know what I'm saying. And I need weeks with him to try and figure out what it is. And then the people who run the program, well, what'd you think of so-and-so? And I'm like, wow, I mean, such a great voice, but the brain is absolutely absent, and like that happens more often with tenors than anybody else, but I can say that because I'm a tenor, it's true. There is listening is a skill. And something I say to young singers all the time, listen, people will tell me, oh, I listen to your elixir. I listen to your whatever, and I'll say, okay, thank you. But if you want to really appreciate what I'm doing, then you got to go back to pre-Pavarotti. You have to go back to Bergonzi. You have to go back to Corelli, who's a guy who I don't sing anything like, but this is where you have to go back to Gigli, Tagliavini, Wunderlich, Gedda. You have to go back to this group, and if you're looking for clues about how to make the voice work right, you should be starting here. Because in those days, all that was going on was singing. And it's not to say that Callas didn't make a great career as an actress also. I mean, she was obviously revered as an actress. But in those days, it was the voice told every part of the story, and the costume and the scenery were just there to support. The movement on the stage was just a function of getting someone on and off, because it was all about the voice. Today we're not there anymore. Today we're a visual audience, and if the visual doesn't represent something to a younger listener, then we haven't succeeded. which is the difficult place to be in an operatic world where the voice is really the thing that's at the front, you know?
Well, since you're talking about that golden age, we'll just take a moment of respect for Renata Scotto, who died yesterday, I think.
I didn't hear
that. Yeah. Oh. Yeah. Yeah. Renata Scotto.
Well, another incredible vocal artist who just told every story I'm not saying she wasn't an actress, but everything that you needed to know about whatever was going on stage was right there inside the sound. Beverly Sills, another one who is as honest as you could possibly find as a singer. You understood everything that was going on, and it didn't matter if she was singing in Swahili. You know, you got it because of the honesty and what was alive inside of her spirit as she poured it out. And I'm sorry to hear about Scotto. That's sad.
Well, would you, Robert, like to comment any more on rehearsal and what the arc of rehearsal is, what it is for you if you're conducting at Houston Grand Opera compared to here? And let me just say this, and I hope it won't be embarrassing, because you made some very bad schedule decisions. Robert is conducting Idomeneo tomorrow, and in a normal world, that would be enough for weeks of effort. But he's conducting Haydn's Creation with the Aspen Festival Orchestra on Sunday, and he is supervising the Aspen Conducting Academy, which concludes its programming this afternoon. And he played a full and extraordinarily ambitious recital with Gil Shaham last week, and performed a different thing at our gala benefit last week. So I think you deserve a raise. And
man, we're talking to the right guy, I think.
But anyway, you're doing a lot of rehearsal lately, and do you have any thoughts about how rehearsal works here, for instance?
I'll take it. The rehearsal process here for everything we do is fast. And it's especially fast for kids. And I think it's a challenge that ends up being very educational. I mean, it's something we can often feel frustrated by or overly challenged by. I often will say, we don't have enough time, we don't have enough time. And we always have enough time. And it's interesting, the amount of time it takes to accomplish something tends to expand into the amount of time available. And conversely, what we can accomplish knowing that we have a limited amount of time, it can often surprise us. And one of the things I think that Cesca did that was so brilliant right at the beginning of the process is she had staged the entire opera in the first 2 days. So everybody knew what we were working on. There wasn't this period where we don't know how it ends or we don't know what we're doing in Act Two. It was rather the plan was set. And so then, and this is a way of working that I try to espouse for my conducting students, is you don't make decisions about what you're doing in an isolated or localized way. You make those so-called minor decisions in the service of your understanding of the whole picture. So what was great was the cast immediately had an understanding of the whole picture, what we were working with and what we were refining. And I noticed that Cesca was using the language in those first couple days. There we have version A. So that by implication, she didn't bother to elucidate, but by implication, everybody understood we're working with this. We're refining this. We're not done. We're only beginning. And yet we got the whole picture. I thought that was absolutely brilliant. And I often work that way with the orchestra, knowing that we have a limited amount of rehearsal time. I'll make sure we have some understanding of the whole thing. I did the same thing with the opera orchestra of getting through the whole opera first. It's an old warning from conductors, don't waste all your time rehearsing the overture. because you can get started rehearsing and want so many refinements that you forget there's a couple hours to go.
Well, just to piggyback on that, especially with young people like this, they don't know what it's like to have to listen to a voice and react. And it's not just because your hand went down and it was time to play, but that they had to play in a manner that supported what we were doing. This is an awesome way for, I mean, like maybe every one of these players might aspire to solo careers. I mean, I have no idea what they all want to do with their lives. But I mean, like, this is a great learning experience for a youth orchestra too, because they're starting to learn, they're learning new music, and the violinists maybe only listening to violin concertos or, you know, clarinetists or, you know, all those things. I mean, like, we're broadening the horizons, which is awesome. And I also, I mean, the natural implication of Cheska version A is she's expecting us to grow. She's expecting us to add. She's expecting us to fill out what we have as a plan. You go here, and then you go here, and all right, and then this is your exit over here, and Neptune's coming from here, and Edamante comes, like, that's just a roadmap. I mean, version A means, yeah, this is how we're starting, and we're building, and we want it to be a complete theatrical experience, even though we don't have a whole set and, you know, scenery and all that sort of thing. We don't have that stuff, but we can still make a complete theatrical experience. And yeah, you're right. That's awesome. Yeah.
You reminded me in what you were saying. Every member of the orchestra asked to be in it. Isn't that great?
Yeah.
They all wanted to do the opera. And the bassoon teacher who's here at the moment, because, you know, we have a number of faculty and various instruments, told me, "What have you done to my student? He wants to play opera."
No, and I will say, I really give credit primarily to Robert, but also to the opera program itself. When I came and the assignments went up, the people assigned to opera were literally crying when they saw that. And now we're at a point where we do not assign. We ask for people to nominate themselves into the opera. And then we have to say, "We're so sorry, there's not room for all of you." But that's a great step. Now, last week I left not even 30 seconds for comments and questions, so I thought we would go to that now. And if you have one, okay, wait for the microphone, and we'll start there in the back.
Hi, I just wanted somebody to comment on Edamante being a mezzo-soprano versus a tenor. I believe in early versions, even Pavarotti played Edamante.
Yeah, I think it was written actually for a castrato in the original production. And then I feel as though it was in the 19th century that it was switched to being primarily, too often, being sung by a tenor. But we're back now to a mezzo-ish.
I've done this part with a countertenor, a male singer. I've sung it with a countertenor. It was, for me, good and bad. The good part was being able to relate to a man, my son, a man. I mean, that was useful. But for me, I was too used to the. He was a great singer, actually, but somehow that sound wasn't the sound I wanted. And that was. This is a very personal thing, by the way. There are lots of people who think that I know plenty of people like that's the only way it should be done. And okay. I mean, like, I like Pavarotti, but you like Domingo, and you know, like, really it's like that. So I'm used to the sound of a mezzo voice. And that's the sound I prefer. But you know, I thought that this guy made a good case for it, because he could sing it all. And he moved naturally like a man, which is something that mezzo-sopranos have to learn. You just have to learn how to do that. And some of them are really, really good at it, and some of them struggle a little bit, but it's that sound for me that I'm more used to anyway.
There was one right here.
Matthew referred to City Opera in New York and the Met, and we know other opera companies around the country, in some cases, are cutting back a bit on the number of productions. In that case, how do you encourage all of these young singers all around the country and the world, for that matter, to think that there is plenty of opportunity for them to have a career in opera? And or are you encouraging to think practically about some other opportunities?
Well, I mean, there's no question we're in a very difficult place now. I mean, I've been singing, this will be my 26th season at the Met. I haven't missed a year since my debut. And it is the first time in that I know the Met dropped six titles in January for the season that started, rehearsals have probably started for whatever the first September thing is. So I never heard of that in my life. I have heard of them flip-flopping a title because a singer doesn't want to do it, that sort of thing. So we're in a difficult place. But usually, what I try to keep saying to myself and what I say to young singers is, opera's been in difficult places before. The arts have suffered at different times all throughout history, and we're in a dark spot right now. But just because we're in a dark spot right now doesn't mean that dark spot is going to continue. And as I said earlier, I mean, like, yeah, it stinks that we don't have city opera, or that the idea that a city of 8 million people can't support arguably the best opera house in the world, or if you don't want to say it's number one, it's got to be in the top two or three. There's no possibility it could be any other when you could think of the quality of the singers that get there, the quality of the orchestra, chorus, etc. Europe is more open to America now than it used to be. And in particular, Germany, which maybe you were here when I don't know if you were here when I was talking about that. But I mean, like, so I often say to them, hey, listen, do your work here, get your master's or whatever, do the stuff you want to do here. But you may end up having to go to Europe. You may end up having to go through those training systems over there. And I would say that American opportunity for younger singers here in America, a young American opportunity might be on the decline, but certainly on the there's still plenty of opportunity overseas where, I mean, let's just face it, opera is a part of their historical background. Opera, these people grew up with it as part of their history, and we've adopted it. You know, and they've adopted Broadway, which is much more American, you know. But this is, you know, I just try to keep my most optimistic face on for them, because I do think that our art form is tremendously important. And yes, it's historical, but I mean, even these things we're facing, yeah, okay, Idomeneo, fine, all right, we don't find too many people out on the ocean with Neptune telling them, you know, kill the first guy you see and I'll let you live. I mean, like, okay, so this, but I mean, like, a lot of operas revolve around themes that are still going on today and are still historically and not historically and they we can relate to all these things now. Because these themes of love and loss and tragedy and joy, all that stuff is still going on today. And it's just a, you know, maybe an old fashioned way of saying it. So I just try to be optimistic with them and say that there are still opportunities out there. You just have to look. And I mean, like, really, when I think about my own career, if I don't meet these two singers at Yale when I was there, if I don't meet Alan Held, who was a bass baritone having a great career when I was 22 or whatever, I forget what age I was, then I don't go to Yale. And if I don't go to Yale, I don't meet Jane Dutton and Bruce Baumer, who studied with Margaret Harshaw. And if I don't study with Margaret Harshaw, I don't think I'm sitting here today. So then beyond that, if I'm not singing at Lyric Opera of Chicago, the first priest in Magic Flute, then Jonathan Friend, who's the artistic administrator of the Met, doesn't hear me. And if he doesn't hear me, I don't go to the Met. I mean, like, so everybody's road is different. And just because the road seems dark right now doesn't mean it's always going to be dark. And let's try and keep a positive aspect.
Well, and I say this not as an overly flip answer, But in 1891, the Metropolitan Opera was building its first dedicated house. That is, they had been appearing in a theater that already existed, and they were building their own house. And the New York Herald Tribune had an article saying, "Are they crazy? There is no future for opera in the U.S. There's the young people don't care about opera. There's going to be no audience, and they're building this gigantic house." So that, of course, became the Old Met later. Let's go to Ilad.
To just continue on that point, I'm a son of a soprano, so I love opera my entire life. I'm obsessed with opera. I go to every Wagner, and I understand that normal people can't consume that. But opera is so wonderful, and I really believe in it. And I'm wondering, just like the changes that you made with the recitativo, how do you think we can attract new audience? Because the product is really great. Maybe marketing is not always the best, but the product is really great, and you're helping the audience find the best parts of it and taking maybe some of the fat out. But what do you think we can do more to attract more audience to the opera? It's like Broadway show on steroids. You have everything in opera.
Well, I'm a believer that the art attracts the audience in the end more than the marketing. And I think it works because akin to Alan's statement about there's no market in New York for opera in 1891, I was reading articles from the 20s, 1920s, about how that the graying of the audience for symphonic music was so notable, there was no new audience. Well, I'm pretty sure they've left. And however challenging it is, the new audiences thing, I have great confidence that that all works out in ways that are our doom and gloom attitude is often just a little ill-informed. I think we're in the middle of a larger shift in the way we collectively spend our leisure time and spend our expendable income, how we engage the world. There's just been a tremendous shift. And we tend in classical music to be pretty navel-gazing and forget that movie theaters and rock concerts and live theater and dance have their own. It's very interesting. The attrition for classical music is actually less than in all those other arenas, including rock and roll. So there's a very unknown aspect to how this is going to play out, I think. And I feel very trusting in the art. My first orchestra was the Brooklyn Philharmonic at BAM, at the Brooklyn Academy of Music in New York. And it has folded. And it's no longer there. It's like City Opera. BAM is fine. The Brooklyn Philharmonic at BAM is gone. And I realized when we folded, I was no longer there. I had left the orchestra. But when it folded, I was still very close to it in my heart, I realized, oh, they folded before. There had been a Brooklyn Philharmonic at the end of the 19th century. When BAM was built, Walt Whitman was the music critic for the Brooklyn Eagle, and he wrote a beautiful article on how Brooklyn now had an opera house to rival those of Europe, and there was a Brooklyn Philharmonic. Mahler conducted at BAM. Busoni played the piano at BAM. Many important U.S. premieres were given at BAM by the Brooklyn Philharmonic of works of little-known composers like Beethoven, Tchaikovsky. So there was this rich history, and then the orchestra folded. And it reconstituted and was the orchestra for whom I was its fourth music director. And now it's gone. But that makes me think. And also, I've been living in Atlanta for 22 years, so I have a strong relationship to the Phoenix now. And things rise again. Ashes are not necessarily wastelands. There is a cycle that these things go through. I think it's akin to what you were saying, Matthew, that we go through cycles of how these institutions run and how audiences behave. And I think we're going to find another way. Even orchestras as we know them really didn't exist until the 60s and into the 70s in terms of how the musicians are employed and how the presentation of concerts is set up. So I just think we collectively have a lot to figure out about all of the ways we interact with each other in these ways that we humanly crave, which is to have shared experiences. We want to be together in a room and have a shared experience. How we're going to do that, I think, is going to be an adventure.
And I'll just add, and then I fear we're going to have to close for the day and for the season. But we have on Sunday as our final concert, Haydn's The Creation. Of course, Robert is leading that performance. It is an extraordinary work. As far as we can tell, looking at the archives, it has never been given in Aspen. It was one of the most important cultural events of its time when Haydn brought it to Vienna. And it was just a sensational success. And I'm not making this up, but about 15 years ago, I commissioned a friend who is a cultural historian and a demographer, and I said, would it be possible to study Vienna of 1798, when the Creation was first performed there, and look at how many people lived there, who were they in the whole greater Vienna area, how many of them were candidates to attend a concert like the Creation? What percentage of the population of Vienna in 1798 were concert goers? And the answer was 3%, which is just about exactly the percentage of Americans who listen to classical music. So it's just something to think about. As I say, I am so sorry, but it is way after I had a 1 o'clock lunch. Thank you so much for being with us all season. And thank you to Matthew Polanzani and Robert Spanel.